Hello, I'm Sonia Rothwell. It's Monday, March the 23rd, in today's podcast. After the death of reality TV star Jade Goody on Sunday, we look at her legacy.
As fewer and fewer of us are attending any sort of organised religion in our lives, the way that she has handled her final days has been very useful.
Indian cricket's much-admired IPL could be coming to Britain. We assess the chances and wonder if we could do the glamour too. And most students leave university with a mountain of debt. We find out how Charles Darwin was no different.
He had people to shine his shoes and make his bed, and you hardly had to lift a finger. He was having a fabulous time as a student.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
All that coming up, but first a look at today's headlines and a flick through the papers.
The US Treasury is to set up public-private partnerships to buy up the toxic debt of bad loans still holding up the recovery of banks. Writing in the Wall Street Journal, the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, says he'll put in $100 billion to start the partnerships. Private companies will be expected to invest equal amounts, but they'll be able to borrow from the government. Mr. Geithner says the process of clearing the loans has to be speeded up. Also in the United States, the Guardians learned that the government wants to have a new prime minister in Afghanistan to bypass President Karzai. Barack Obama has denounced his new policy for the country at an international conference next week. It will also recommend a major increase in military and police services in Afghanistan. In the northern US state of Montana, a plane's crashed with at least 16 people on board. All are believed to have been killed, including several children. The turboprop plane crashed as it was approaching the airport at the town of Butte. The British actress Natasha Richardson has been buried in her hometown in Upper New York State. Her family was joined by her mother Vanessa and sister Jolie. Other well-known actors also at the funeral were Ralph Fiennes and Alan Rickman. Natasha died last week after a skiing accident. She was 45. The Conservative Party has insisted that it's still committed to abolishing inheritance tax for estates worth less than £1 million. This was after the business spokesman Ken Clark said that he no longer regarded it as a priority if the Tories get back in power. He was forced to modify his comments on what had been a party election pledge. He said that the party was still committed to the policy within the first parliament. As the football season draws to a close, an exciting result for Liverpool in the Premiership. They hammered Aston Villa 5-0. This brings them to within 1 point of league leaders Manchester United, who have one game in hand. Man U themselves were surprisingly beaten this weekend by lowly Fulham. That's the cheerful story on the sports pages of the morning papers. Gerrard and his rampaging Reds relaunch title race, writes The Guardian, reporting Gerrard's hat-trick of goals. The Mail has a picture of the Liverpool captain jumping in the air, saying that he's flying high, while the Express thumbs its nose at Man U. Cop that, Fergie. Rafa's threat after Anfield bunch of fives reads their headline. The front pages of the tabloids all have pictures of Jade Goody, who died yesterday. Mummy's in heaven, says the Mirror. At peace on Mother's Day is the way the Sun puts it. In the Guardian, the headline reads, at peace and finally out of the limelight. The Mail says that she was unique and brave and leaves a legacy that might just save lives by encouraging other young women to come forward for cancer tests. The Independent goes out on its own. It has a heroic picture of the England women's team celebrating after winning the Cricket World Cup. It also tells us that British scientists hope to become the first to create synthetic blood by using stem cells. It will be used to offer infection-free blood transfusions. The Telegraph leads on the controversy over the Tory policy on death duties. The Times reports that hopes rise for British hostages held in Iraq. It says that came after a fresh video emerged of the five men, showing that they were still alive. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The death of Jade Goody on Mother's Day, a twist even Big Brother producers couldn't have dreamed up, has prompted countless affectionate tributes, including one from the Prime Minister. As people reflect on her death, though, The Guardian's Libby Brooks considers its ramifications.
The most obvious ramification is the fact that cervical cancer screening rates have gone up so massively since she first started talking about her own experience with the smear tests and missing tests and so forth. And, you know, that's obviously a very positive outcome and something that she, you know, talked about herself. As far as the kind of broader cultural ramifications are concerned, I think it says a lot about our way of dealing with death, because as fewer and fewer of us are attending any sort of organised religion in our lives, I think we're losing any sense of the old rituals that people had around death and dying and mourning. And so I think simply to be having discussions about this particular case and the way that she has handled her final days has been very useful.
We had an almost unprecedented amount of coverage. Is that going to stop now, that coverage, or do you think that this story will continue to be of interest to people long after Jade's death?
I have to say I very much doubt that the appetite is going to diminish simply because she's no longer on the scene. But in a way, I do hope that the media does withdraw as much as they possibly can to allow the family to conduct its mourning in private. I suppose the question is whether now that her mother and her husband have got so used to conducting this publicly, whether they will in fact continue to do so.
In many ways, Jade is irreplaceable. Basically, the place that she took in the nation's consciousness, she represented part of society which is very rarely represented in such a high profile way. I mean, she came from a very deprived background. She didn't have a great start in life. Do you think that there is anybody who can play that role as well as she did?
I think the thing with Jade was that she found it impossible to be anything other than absolutely herself. And most people, when they get into that position in the public eye, work very hard to construct some sort of persona, either to protect themselves from celebrity or to enhance their celebrity. Whereas Jade, one felt, was nothing other than 100% herself. And so, no, I don't feel that there's really anybody else around at the moment who can step into her shoes.
Libby Brooks. And there's much more about Jade Goody at guardian.co.uk. They paved the way to power for Afghan President Hamid Karzai, but there are increasing signs that the Americans no longer have any confidence in his ability to lead a state that, for many commentators, has failed. In some parts of Washington, Mr. Karzai is seen as part of the problem and not the solution to the crisis in Afghanistan and Pakistan. With elections due there in August, the campaign to moderate Mr. Karzai's influence has begun. The Guardian's Julian Borgia explains why.
Well, there's a long souring of this marriage between the NATO country, the US and Europe mainly, and Karzai. He was the best thing since sliced bread at the beginning in 2001. But his failure really to clean up his government in terms of corruption and competence has really led to a deep disillusion. And there was floating the idea that they would look for some kind of alternative and back him, as it would inevitably be in Afghanistan, or him. But they haven't really come up with any viable alternatives. And so the latest idea is try and install alongside him someone who to do the heavy executive work from the presidency, a kind of prime ministerial chief executive figure who they could rely on to get stuff done in terms of governance.
So who's driving this?
The US, but with support from French, the British, and the main troop contributing countries in ISAF, because there's a kind of question of what are we fighting for if the government in Kabul seems unwilling or unable to take up governance and to extend its reach and provision of services into the areas that some of the areas in the south and the east that NATO forces are fighting to kind of, you know, to drive the Taliban out.
I hesitate to use the phrase, but it does sound, to all intents and purposes, like the Allies want another regime change.
Yes, or a regime adjustment. They want a more efficient government in Kabul, so they've got something better to fight for, really. But they also realise that the idea of a centralised government that was imagined in 2001, 2002, is not going to happen. It just doesn't work in a country like Afghanistan with such poor communications and with such a history of the last 30 years. So they're looking more to strengthening provincial and district government, which they think may be more effective. It might lead better returns in terms of investing in infrastructure. And so strengthening that inevitably dilutes central government. Hamid Karzai is uneasy about this and has warned the West not to meddle in Afghan politics, not treat it like a puppet state. But ultimately, they are paying the money and sending the troops, and there's a diminishing stomach for this war, and they want to get results soon, so they'll do what they feel they have to do.
Julian Borgia, and you can read more on the background to that story at guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website, the scandal engulfing the Royal Bank of Scotland is further heating up after reports of the intimidation of former directors. Guardian.co.uk/business. Gordon Brown explains how Al-Qaeda is still a threat to UK security. Guardian.co.uk/politics. And find out how to birdwatch from the comfort of your sofa. And no, I don't mean by using Google Street View. Guardian.co.uk/environment. And coming up, it was the last feudal state in Europe. But now democracy's come to the Channel Island of Sark, how has life changed?
And we're all more or less aiming in the same direction at long last. It's quite pleasant to be there in comparison to what it was like last year.
But first, there's news that's got cricket fans in the UK in a cold sweat of anticipation. The glitz of the Indian Premier League could be on its way to Britain as the organisers decided to pull the tournament from its Indian home because of mounting fears over security. India's loss will mean a boost for another venue as countries queue up offering their commiserations and their cricketing facilities. Guardian sports writer Owen Gibson explains.
There's been concerns over whether the IPL can take place in India ever since the attack on a Sri Lankan bus in Pakistan. Basically because obviously heightened security concerns across the region, and it's also taking place at the same time as the general elections in India, basically. So the Indian government said they would find it difficult to guarantee security both at the IPL cricket venues and at polling stations across the country. So ever since then, there's been a to and fro between the IPL organisers, the BCCI and the government. These negotiations basically come to an end with the news that they couldn't find any common ground, and that the IPL said they were going to try and move lock, stock and barrel to another country.
An entire tournament to somewhere on the other side of the world. There must be some huge complications in that. I mean, one of the places that's been mooted as being a venue has been the UK. I mean, how likely is it that the UK is going to be able to host this?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's obviously massive logistical challenges involved with moving an entire tournament, taking in more than sort of 60 games, lock, stock and barrel, to another country within the space of 3 weeks. The mooted alternatives are, as you say, England, South Africa and somewhere in the Middle East, most probably Dubai. I think that there's a sort of collective will from the cricket world, if you like, to see it go ahead. It's been a huge shot in the arm for the world of cricket, and certainly the world of cricket in the subcontinent, and it would be hugely embarrassing, and not to say hugely expensive for the Indian authorities to have to cancel it altogether.
What's been the reaction in India to the news that the IPL had to move elsewhere?
The reaction in India has been mixed, actually. I mean, obviously, those involved in the IPL, and they include some sort of quite high-profile Bollywood actors and actresses and some big business figures, they're pleased it's going ahead at all, and they've all come out in support of the decision. But already the initial reaction, at least from some of the Indian public, seems to be definitely more mixed, and there's some people coming out and saying this is a disaster, that it's hugely embarrassing, not only for Indian cricket authorities, but for India as a nation, and they're saying, this should never have been allowed to come to this, basically, that the Indian government should have found a way to ensure that this highly prestigious and highly sort of visible around the globe competition could have continued. And I think that feeling is likely to kind of spiral as the week goes on, if we get a decision to definitely move it.
What's the likelihood that it could come to Britain? I mean, what advantages does Britain have over South Africa? I mean, clearly not weather advantages.
No, the weather won't be obviously be as good over here as it would be in South Africa. But it seems that England is emerging as a marginal favourite over South Africa, and I think the main reason for that is that not only have we got the infrastructure and we've got the stadiums, but there's crucially there'd be some of the sort of glamour and excitement and some of the sort of diverse crowds that you wouldn't necessarily see in South Africa, and it would also work timing-wise, as would South Africa, in that they'd start games either at 11:30 in the morning or 3:30 in the afternoon, which would then still see them played at prime time for Indian television audiences.
It's going to be a nice curtain raiser, isn't it, for the English season, the English cricketing season, if it were to be here. Is it going to clash in any way with the cricketing season? Because I know we have some high-profile players that actually play in the IPL.
Well, that's right. That's one of the interesting questions. Obviously, Kevin Peterson and Andrew Flintoff, among others, are due to be playing in the IPL, but they were supposed to only be playing for the first 3 weeks, and then they were due to come home and play for England against the West Indies in this country. And then also this summer, you've got the ICC World 2020, which is a big sort of international 2020 competition. And then obviously later in the summer, we've got the Ashes. So it's already an incredibly packed calendar. So you could have a fantastic packed summer of cricket, or if it all goes wrong, it could end up with sort of more egg on the face of the ECB.
Guardian sports writer Owen Gibson. Now, when most of us have a clear out of the loft or the garage, a lot of the stuff we find isn't frankly of much interest. When librarians at the University of Cambridge were sorting through some rather boring-looking files, though, they unearthed some papers that shed some quite interesting light on the student career of one of the world's greatest naturalists, Charles Darwin. The Guardian's Polly Curtis described the picture they paint.
Well, it really shows that he had this incredibly pampered life, where he had people to shine his shoes and make his bed, and you hardly had to lift a finger. He was having a fabulous time as a student, and it shows kind of very small details, like the fact that he spent more than any other student on coal. And we know all through his life that he had a coal fire blazing in his office, and he was wearing, in all those photos and portraits of him in very hot places, he always wore a very heavy coat, so it's another sign of his kind of cold constitution.
So he suffered a lot from the cold. I don't know about you, Polly, but when I was a student, I had all these sorts of expenses. I had shoe shiners, I had scullions.
Oh, yeah.
What else does this reveal about the life of a student at that time, especially one who came from quite a privileged background like Darwin did?
Well, it just reveals that it was an incredibly privileged thing to do. You had to do a couple of hours of lectures every day, but the rest of the time is really your own. And you had people at your beck and call. I mean, every student had a gyp, which was basically a servant who woke you up in the morning by making your fire and bringing your tea. And you went down to chapel, and when you got back, there was your lovely breakfast waiting there for you. And you had someone who was making your clothes and a hatter, people doing your laundry, and a seamstress repairing your buttons and they fell off, and you know, all manner of kind of luxuries.
So what sort of student was Darwin? What do we get an impression of somebody who was profligate with his money, somebody who spent a lot of it on alcohol, like I suppose a lot of students do?
We know that he was definitely a bit of a boozer, because there was a friend who did a little portrait of him, a kind of cartoony portrait, and a tankard of beer that was his little logo. It shows that he didn't pay his bills very regularly, but that wasn't much of a problem because the college didn't ask for them very regularly, because this was really a land of wealth and no one really worried about money that much.
So how much, compared with students now, did he spend?
Well, it was about just over £600, which was an incredible amount of money then. And I used one of those kind of online Google tools to work out what it was equivalent to now, and it's about £31,000 now. Average spending over 3 years of a degree is now about £24,000. For him, he spent the equivalent of £31,000, so he was certainly having a nice time.
Guardian Education Editor Polly Curtis. He recently lost his role as the feudal lord of the Channel Island of Sark, but at least Michael Beaumont, the seigneur of the tiny crown dependency, holds on to his unique right to keep doves. That is one of the few perks he has left, after residents voted to abolish Europe's last feudal state. Stephen Morris has been to Sark to find out how things have changed.
Come on! Come on! Breakfast!
On cue, four doves flutter down and are fed by Michael Beaumont, the seigneur of Sark. It's a peaceful scene, a stark contrast to 3 months ago, when the island's first democratic elections took place. Then there was bitter feuding between two opposing factions for control of the first elected parliament. Broadly speaking, one side favoured Beaumont and the old feudal ways of this small Channel Island. A second faction backed the Barclay brothers, the billionaire owners of the Telegraph and the Ritz Hotel, who have invested millions in the island's tourist industry. The Barclays lost badly in the elections and promptly shut down all their businesses, leaving Sark facing ruin. We've returned to see if life is a little quieter now, 3 months on.
Michael Beaumont, senior of Sark.
So how's democracy treating you?
Very well, thank you, yes. Delighted to see it in at last. It's been a long haul, but we're there.
There's been two meetings so far. What's the atmosphere been like at them?
Well, quite different to what it was before. Totally different. And we're all more or less aiming in the same direction at long last. So it's quite pleasant to be there in comparison with what it was like last year.
Are you missing your powers? You've lost. You have a voice in the Parliament, but you don't get to vote. Do you miss that?
No, I don't really. No. I mean, I've reached an age where I think I can retire a bit.
And what about the atmosphere on the island in general? Last time I was here, there was a split, two very different factions. Has that dissipated?
That's more or less gone, yes. The island's all considerably happier and more relaxed than it was when you were last here.
I think it was unfortunate that people became so polarised, but they were partly driven to it by things that were going on at the time. But as you can imagine, on a little island of 600 people, you can't go on not speaking to each other forever. You have to make things work. My name is Jan Guy, and I'm one of Sark's two visitor officers. I'm also an elected conseiller.
So last time I was here, Jan, all the businesses were being shut down, and we thought, is this the end of Sark as we know it?
Yeah, well, fortunately, it definitely wasn't the end of Sark as we know it. Some of the businesses shut down, most of them actually didn't. Although it is normal for businesses related to tourism to be closed during the winter, only a few stay open. I'm delighted to be able to tell you that all the businesses reopened quite quickly and everything is on track, and we were able to reassure visitors that their holiday is safe and sound and Sark is as gorgeous as ever.
I'm Lieutenant Colonel Reg Gill and I'm the Seneschal of Sark.
One of the most impressive things for me at the time of the election was how many people came out and voted and how many people stood for election. Is there still that continuing interest in the process?
I believe there will be. The people did turn out in large numbers, and I'm hopeful that that will continue into the future. In 2 years' time, we will have our first election completely under the new law, and I'm hopeful that we'll get a good turnout, possibly 60-70%, and a number of candidates who may have been unsuccessful last time who wish to throw their hat in the ring again.
60-70% is so much higher than the mainland UK. Are the things that Sark can teach the UK?
Well, I think we're just a small community, and people in a small community tend to know what's going on. And take an interest in what is being done for them. Government is not at arm's length in Sark. You walk down the road, you'll see your concierge working in the shops, on the roads, around the cliffs, and people can stop and talk to them all the time. So politics is not at arm's length on Sark. And I'm not sure we can teach a population of 60-70 million people how to do it. No. Our democracy is our democracy, and other people just have to work for the best they can.
That's all from Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's podcast will be available to download from 7 a.m. Today's producers were Francesca Panetta and Tim Mabey. I'm Sonia Rothwell. Thanks for listening.